Hello and welcome to the London Philharmonic Orchestra's April podcast. I'm Edward Seckerson. With a particularly appetising variety of concerts on offer this month at the South Bank Centre's Royal Festival Hall, three conductors, Vladimir Yurovsky, Yannick Nézet-Séguin and Marin Alsop, are on hand to talk about the music they'll be performing. Yannick also introduces his first CD release on the LPO label, Brahms's inspirational German Requiem. Don't forget that you can find out more about all our concerts and recordings on the orchestra's website, www.lpo.org.uk, or through its popular free iPhone app. On Saturday the 10th of April, Yannick Nézet-Séguin conducts the fourth of his series of concerts this season as the orchestra's principal guest conductor. There'll be fireworks in more ways than one, Handel's music for the Royal Fireworks, and Stravinsky's short, sharp, colourful display, paired with Prokofiev's first violin concerto, a kind of Beauty and the Beast tale with soloist Lisa Batiashvili, and the symphony which redefined the way we think of rhythm, Beethoven's Storming Seventh. There's a concert on the 10th of April where there will be fireworks.
Yes.
Stravinsky and Handel, yes. To be precise.
To be precise. But Beethoven, don't you think that in Beethoven we have lots in that one?
We do, but we also have that universal dancing, you know?
Yes, exactly.
That Seventh Symphony.
Yes.
It has to be, as regards rhythm, the most exciting use of it almost in the repertoire, I think.
Absolutely. And for that reason, the most difficult. I'm not saying the most difficult of all the symphonies, the most difficult rhythmically. Because of that use of rhythms, which also are easy pitfalls as well. This very yam, padam, pam, padam, pam, padam, pam. But it's so infectious. Mm. It is constructed in such a way. I don't think in any of his symphonies does Beethoven go so mad. And I can't really remember who was saying that, but it's mad to the point of almost being like a drunk man. I always imagine Beethoven sketching it mostly having too much of white wine in his favorite pub, you know? Mm. That's the way I'm imagining it. And for all its nobility and for all that wonderful second movement, which there still is a lilt in it, which is
still
very...
an element of the dance.
Absolutely. And this program has been a program I've done last year in Rotterdam, and Tim Walker was interested in doing it also in London, because it worked actually quite well to emphasize that, like you say, universal dancing, but in to the point of being at the end almost under, not anymore under control.
Yeah. Is there anything more exciting than that last movement?
No.
I don't think there is that.
Exactly. I mean, you get, of course, chills after at the end of Beethoven 9, the very end of Eroica is this kind of rush, but this, the build-up of the 7th is extraordinary. Combine it with obvious fireworks of Handel, which is all based on dance anyway, because as all these suites are, and yet a very early Stravinsky with his Feu d'Artifice, which is an extremely difficult piece rhythmically as well, very short, condensed. All Stravinsky is there, in a way, in those 4 or 5 minutes. All of this quite different from Prokofiev's first violin concerto. And the idea of Prokofiev and Stravinsky within that was to emphasize more their neoclassical approach, but also the connection with it in Prokofiev 1 is that it's a relatively unusual piece, even for Prokofiev. And we needed some kind of calm in that program.
Yes.
And this one is the most French one. So it's might be less of a firework, but more... Well, let's put it another way. It might be, you know, when you one attends a real fireworks show, there's always these big ones, and then there's always a moment where it's only just boiling, you know, next to the ground, and you never can't see them unless you are actually close. It's an oasis of beauty, purity. Yet Prokofiev is always neoclassical in everything he's writing. And so that was more the connection to that program. So a very unusual program, I feel.
It really is. And I suppose that the dying moments of Prokofiev, which are like this wonderful fairy tale dream almost.
Completely.
And then to go after, it's a pity there's an interval almost.
Yes.
You know, to go into the earthiness of the
and
Beethoven.
What I like, and I know that Vladimir is doing this so well as a programmer, it's fantastic, but it's also not to systematically have a chronological order in a concert. It's also very telling, and that's the example there, you know, to finish with Beethoven. It's so universal, and then we can draw our lines differently than just saying, oh yes, that was early and then that came later. I think it's much more in terms of a real meal and not necessarily of that purely historic line.
And what about your soloist in the Prokofiev? Because she is a poet, a Russian poet.
Incredible. She is a poet,
Lisa Batyashvili.
She's we've done Prokofiev's second violin concerto actually for my Berlin debut last year, and this was fantastic. And then after that second violin concerto, we said, well, we should collaborate again, and we all confessed, not all, but both of us confessed after the concert that we preferred the first violin concerto. But what amazes me with her is the maturity and the nobility of the playing. She is one who is, and you've said poet, and I think it said it all. She's one who's able to convince by just the sheer beauty of the way she's conducting the musical line, in a very intense way, but not with any histrionics or anything, which unfortunately the violin repertoire is full of that anyway. And so I'm not accusing violinists necessarily, but it's easy to cave in to that aspect in almost a perverse way. You have the effect of seeing fireworks, and then yet you have maybe the most anti-fireworks of young violinists.
Marin Alsop conducts two concerts in mid-April. On the 17th, new works by Philip Glass and Mark Antony Turnage precede Henrik Goretzky's extraordinary Third Symphony, the Symphony of Sorrowful Songs, which became a worldwide recording phenomenon in the early 1990s. Few of us knew Goretzky's name before that time. Almost overnight, he was topping the classical charts like a pop star. The second concert with Marin Alsop on the 21st of April brings us Leonard Bernstein's Second Symphony, The Age of Anxiety, with pianist Nicholas Hodges. This intriguing piece, part symphony, part piano concerto, was inspired by and named after W.H. Auden's prose poem, and takes us on a voyage of self-discovery with amazing use of that most tried and tested of musical devices, the theme and variations. Marin Alsop is artistic director of the South Bank Centre's festival, The Bernstein Project, something very close to my heart too, and we spoke about it last year. In your Bernstein Project, which you are artistic director, You're doing Age of Anxiety, the Second Symphony, Bernstein, with the orchestra. To me, it demonstrates so well the kind of compositional gamesmanship that Lenny loved to play with, you know, the way the variations, the tail of each variation creates the next variation. Those little games he would play, which were like puzzles almost, mm-hmm. and yet the whole piece sounds so emotive.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a piece that was inspired and, I don't know, based on might be a little bit too literal, the epic poem by W.H. Auden called Age of Anxiety. Mm. And it's an enormous poem. I mean, it must be 90 pages long, huge. And I've read it dozens of times. And I think that, at least for me, I'm comfortable with the way Bernstein has transliterated the poem into the music. And so there's a natural, organic quality about it because it is following these characters in the poem. The poem is divided, as if I recall correctly, into at least two, maybe three major parts. I mean, two major parts and then an intro and an epilogue. But there's seven different sections in each part, and the characters go through various adventures and metamorphoses. And I think by connecting each variation, you get the sense of this continuity of character. Yes. And Bernstein was brilliant at that. I think the first piece where that's extremely obvious is in the Serenade based on Plato's Symposium.
That's a great
and of course,
too.
That's a story that people think, oh, that's so erudite. But it's really not. It's really a fun story because all these people sitting around, they decide to talk about love. And the idea is that wherever one speaker leaves off, you have to pick up. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where Bernstein originally got this idea to start each variation with the exact same tune or whatever.
Yes.
But I think Age of Anxiety is a very underrated piece, a very, very strong piece,
yes,
but highly unusual still. Yeah.
Well, it's coming. His pieces are getting done more.
Well, I think there are, and I've had, just this past season, I've had an enormous triumph with his Mass. We did it at Baltimore. We recorded
piece.
It, and we performed it at Carnegie Hall and at the Kennedy Center, sold-out audiences. And finally, to see the critical and also the audience, I think the audience reaction has always been very positive, but fantastic critical acclaim for the piece. And I hope you're happy because I know that was one of the pieces that he struggled to come to terms with when the response was not as positive as he had hoped.
In keeping with his tirelessly inquisitive nature, principal conductor Vladimir Yurovsky offers a fascinating programme on the 28th of April. Prokofiev's Sinfonia Concertante for cello and orchestra is paired with Miaskovsky's Sixth Symphony. To say that it's among the best known of his 27 symphonies isn't saying a great deal, because all those symphonies have been woefully neglected on the world's concert platforms. The Sixth, said by some to be the most significant Russian symphony between Tchaikovsky's Pathetique and Shostakovich's Fourth, is a monumental choral symphony of heroism and revolution, springing from very personal tragedy. Miaskovsky was born in 1881, entering the St. Petersburg Conservatory at the age of 25, where Rimsky-Korsakov and Glazunov were among his teachers. Later on, he became a strong champion of both Prokofiev and Stravinsky. So, what does Miaskovsky's Sixth Symphony sound like?
Mm-hmm. The world of the Sixth Symphony, which we're performing, is still to be seen somewhere between the visionary world of Scriabin, the late Romantic Russian school, especially composers like Leadov, Rimsky-Korsakov, and the modernity of such people as Prokofiev, who was Myaskovsky's younger friend, and definitely Stravinsky. But I also can't help hearing a lot of allusions with Mahler and especially Bruckner. This is another colossal work, an hour long, which was written following very tragic personal circumstances of Myaskovsky's life, whose father was a white guardist and officer, was lynched by the crowd. He was decapitated. It happened towards the end of the civil war in Russia, following the 1917 Bolshevist revolution. And Myaskovsky uses the ancient Orthodox text towards the very end of the... That's another usage of the text in the symphony. He introduces the choir. And the theme of this short poem is the separation of the body and the soul after the death of a person. And this final movement makes me think of the final movement of Rachmaninoff's vocal symphony, The Bells, the text of Edgar Allan Poe, where in the final movement the tormented soul of the human being finds its peace beyond the physical existence of the body. So in a way, this work could not have possibly been appreciated in the times of total rejection of religion, of any metaphysical subject in the society. And that's why we paired it with another epoch-making work of the 20th century, Prokofiev's Concerto Symphony for Cello and the Orchestra, one of the very last works Prokofiev wrote, which he wrote already after the severe criticisms of 1948, where he was alongside with Shostakovich and Myaskovsky, was being accused of formalism, a mortal sin back then in the eyes of Stalinist culture bureaucrats. Again, this is a deeply tragic work where any moments of lightness and humor sound more like a biting sarcasm and a hysterical laughter. There is also a very unorthodox usage of a folk theme. There is a folk tune in the final movement, a Ukrainian folk tune of a very well-known peasant song, a very jolly tune, which Prokofiev almost turns into its opposite. He makes it the weapon of his biting sarcasm. But at the same time, you can feel that this is somebody writing the music who is running out of his life energy. And in fact, this work became one of the last, very last Prokofiev managed to finish. It was written under the vivid collaboration and participation of then very young genius cellist Mstislav Rostropovich, to whom the work is dedicated. And we are presenting this work in our concert with a very young German-Japanese cellist, Danjulo Ishizaka, who was one of the last pupils of Boris Pergamenchikov, the late Russian cellist, who in a way continued the line which started with Rostropovich.
New recordings. This month's CD release is of Brahms's German Requiem, conducted by Yannick Nezet-Séguin with soloists Elizabeth Watts and Stéphane Degout and the London Philharmonic Choir, recorded at a concert in April last year. I was there and I was deeply impressed. Brahms's Requiem for the Living, as I like to think of it, shone and thundered, inspiring awe and consolation in equal measure. I can't honestly remember when it last sounded so all-enveloping. Clearly this piece is very close to Yannick's heart, and I leave you with his introduction to the work and to his performance. Thanks for listening.
I'm very happy that my first release on the LPO record label is this Brahms Requiem, which is a work I cherish and I've been fortunate enough to sing when I was a boy, and on several occasions actually, and also when I was a teenager. And it was one of the very first choral pieces and even symphonic pieces that I ever conducted when I was 21. So to introduce my vision of the work to the London audience last year and now to a wider audience is very special to me. The Brahms Requiem is a very unusual work because it's the work first of a collage of various texts, biblical texts, which the counterpoint of which makes another layer of meaning to the original text of the Bible. And it shows, it gives us an opportunity to understand Brahms' mind and reaction towards death and life. This is why Brahms wanted originally to call it a human requiem, not necessarily German, but something for him which would transcend any kind of religious beliefs to a more general philosophical, metaphysical approach to life and death. Its structure is also relatively unusual, with two soloists, the baritone soloist being there twice and the soprano soloist being sort of in the middle of it as an evocation of his mother who had just passed away. And the text of that movement between the mother and the chorus, who are actually representing her children, is something which I find especially touching and intimate in Brahms' music. But the structure of the work itself as well is very grand and has this function almost like pillars of a big church with a very symmetrical approach, the first and the last movement being in the same key, ending with the same words, ending with the same chords. So it has a lot to admire on a pure architectural point of view. But more importantly, I think it's a very, very moving work. When we performed that piece, it was obviously not in a church, but in a concert hall. The challenge for this is always to create the right atmosphere, which has to be dedicated, spiritual. But then the concert hall also allows to hear in greater detail the richness of the orchestration and the way it does combine with the choir. The orchestra in that work is so important, and yet it is really to the service of the choral lines. Brahms was also a great admirer of Renaissance choral music. He was actually a collector of that music and would study it with great care. This is why also Brahms' Requiem has its roots really to many centuries before, and that, for us, I think, as a modern audience, helps us feeling really connected to something to eternity, to history as a greater concept while we're listening to this work.